For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Tonight, we're back in 1 Thessalonians. We're in chapter 5, which is in the middle of a discussion that Paul's having about the end of history. And it weaves in one of the three main themes that drive this letter. And in fact, it really kind of informed the heart of what the Christian life is about. There are three things about the Christian life that the Bible just consistently goes back to: faith, hope, and love. And Paul begins his letter to the Thessalonians reminding them of these three things, and then he ends the letter also with these things. And in the body of the letter, he kind of explores what the life of faith is about and what it means to really live out Christ-like love. And then he finishes the body of the letter with this discussion about the future hope that we have in Christ and the end of human history. And so what we've been talking about basically is how this passage answers three questions. They're vital questions. They're questions that whether you're familiar with the Bible or not, you have, because you're human, because you're conscious, because you're aware. And these are the questions that we have. The first is, what happens to me when I die? And Paul addresses that. And we talked about this at some length last week, where he says in chapter 4, verse 13, we don't want you to be unaware, brothers and sisters, of those who are asleep. That's just the biblical kind of euphemism or shorthand for death. He says, for those who have died, so that you will not grieve as the rest who have no hope. And so Paul's laying out here in this paragraph that we talked about last week, what happens to a person when they die? And the fact that God is going to resurrect, when we die, our spirit goes immediately into the presence of God. And when he returns, our bodies are joined with our spirits, because we are whole people. We're not just disembodied spirits. God has created human beings to be a composite of soul and body. And that's what's going to happen when we die. There's an answer to the problem of death. Death is not the end of the story. And so Paul really wants us to understand, and it's really central to our hope. How could you have hope if this is all there is? And so he explores that question. And then tonight he's going to talk about the other two, which are, where is the future heading? Where is it all going? Is there an end to this thing? And when will it happen? So those are two fairly big questions, aren't they? Where is it all heading? And when does the end occur? And so here's where he goes with that. He says in verse 1 of chapter 5, now as to the times and epics, brethren, we have no need of anything to be written to you. It's an interesting sentence for a couple of reasons. First, he introduces the new topic, namely this idea of times and epics. The times deal with when the end is going to occur, and epics are the eras of human history, the final concluding moment of human history is what he's referring to there, and what happens when Christ returns. So that's our topic. It's interesting, though, that he says we have no need of anything to be written to you. Paul was probably with this church no more than a couple of months before he was run out of town. And what makes this letter so interesting is that it reveals the things that Paul explored with them and taught them while he was with them. This letter having been written very shortly after he left to answer particular questions that they had. But it gives us this incredible window into what is the earliest teaching about Christ. Having been written at about 48 to 49 AD, this gives us this window into the belief, the teaching of the early church 15 years after the time of Christ. And one of the things that was just central to Paul's teaching was the fact that Christ is going to return and is going to set up his kingdom on the earth. And that's why he says, we don't have any need of anything to be written to you about these things, because we explained them to you when we were with you. It was that kind of a priority. But then he does go on and he begins to interact with particular questions about this that were emerging in their church. So I want to talk a little bit about this whole idea of the end of history as the Bible describes it here tonight, and go back to a chart that we looked at last week, where the Bible really describes history in linear terms. And by linear, I mean that the Bible teaches that there was a beginning. You know, Genesis 1, verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And a sequence of meaningful events occurs in history, and then there is an end to history. It's not like this thing just goes on forever the way it is, and which is very unique, and it is absolutely unique to biblical faith, the idea that history follows a progression of events that culminates in what they call an eschaton, in the end, the establishing of God's personal rule on the earth. The faiths of Asia, for instance, or animistic Native American faith, all the kind of faith traditions that people ascribe to outside of the biblical tradition, don't have this view of history. It's just that things go on forever as they are, through a process of cycles, just like the cycles of nature, where spring gives rise to summer, that gives rise to fall, that gives rise to winter, that life unfolds, you live, you die, and it's just the cycle of life, as the movie has it. There's no purpose to it. There's no meaning. It's not going anywhere. And but the Bible says, oh no, history is going someplace, that the sovereign Lord is unfolding his plan for humanity in the very pages of history itself. And it begins from the New Testament's perspective, after God's Old Testament dealings with Israel, with the church age. And that is to say that God is presently working out his plan for humanity through the church. It's through the church that God sends his message of reconciliation with God through Christ to all the nations. So Jesus says in his parting words to his disciples after he was resurrected from the dead in Matthew chapter 28:19, he says, go therefore to all the nations, to all the peoples of the earth, to all the distinct language and cultural groups, and explain to them what I have done. And he says, lo, I will be with you even to the end of the age. And so one of the things that is accomplished in the church age is the dissemination of the message about Christ to all the peoples of the earth. And the second thing that occurs in the church age that we know for sure from the Bible, from Jesus' own words, is in Matthew 24, verse 15, is the restoration of the nation of Israel. That these are things that occur before the end of human history comes into focus. That's a rather amazing detail for Jesus to add, actually, because when Jesus made this prediction about the restoration of Israel, Israel had already been in existence as a nation. They were under Roman occupation, but they existed until 70 AD, when Titus, the Roman general, came in and destroyed the city of Jerusalem, and the people were dispersed, and they've been dispersed for nearly 2,000 years until in 1948. They were brought together again as a nation in the most unlikely of possible scenarios after the Holocaust in Europe, with the plan to essentially erase Judaism from the face of the earth. And this is a miraculous event in history, the regathering of God's people, and it signals the final necessary achievement to the church age. And so with that in view, we talked about that a little bit last week, the next great era of biblical history is the seven-year tribulation period, in which, as we talked about last week, either at the very beginning of it, which I think is what the Bible teaches, or as some have interpreted, at the end of the tribulation period, Christ comes back to resurrect from the dead believers in him. That's the resurrection of the body that Paul was talking about in 1 Thessalonians 4, and also this idea of the rapture, or the fact that some of us will not experience physical death, that when Christ comes back for his church, that in a twinkling of an eye, in a moment, we are translated into the very presence of God. Well, that's a fascinating piece. We talked about that at some detail last week. We can't get into it now this week. If you want to get the tape, it's, of course, available at the bookstore. tonight what we want to talk about is this last period after the seven-year tribulation period, where essentially God's adversaries are running the table, and man at his technologically most advanced is able to see what he can do in a world devoid of God's people. And that is what the seven-year tribulation period is about, terminating in the physical, historical return of Jesus Christ to the earth to establish his 1,000-year rule on the earth as messianic king. And then at the end of that 1,000-year period of time comes what is called the Great White Throne Judgment, where God brings all people into account before him, and judgments are issued that establish the eternal destiny of all persons. And during that phase then as well, then God establishes a new heaven and a new earth. And this is the basic biblical framework for history. Now, tonight we want to just follow a couple of real key questions here. Where is history going that Paul interacts with, and when does it happen? So let's get into our text. We read verse 1. Now, as to times and epochs, brethren, we don't have need of anything to be written to you, for you yourselves know full well that the day of the Lord will come just like a thief in the night. And while they are saying peace and safety, then destruction will come upon them suddenly like labor pains upon a woman with child, and they will not escape. But you, brethren, are not in the darkness that the day would overtake you like a thief. For you are all sons of light and sons of the day. And we are not of the night nor of darkness. So then, let us not sleep as others do, but let us be alert and sober. For those who sleep do their sleeping at night, and those who get drunk at night. But since we are of the day, let us be sober, having put on the breastplate of faith and love, and as a helmet, the hope of salvation. So that's a real mouthful, that passage right there. There's a whole lot going in. Let's unpack it point by point. First point of two. He says, you yourselves know full well that the day of the Lord will come like a thief in the night. The day of the Lord is a term that Paul is using that is rich in Old Testament vocabulary. The prophets in the Old Testament look to the future of God establishing his rule on the earth, and they called it the day of the Lord. And so you see this, for example, in the book of Joel, chapters 2 and 3, and in almost all of the other prophets as well. It's the idea that the day of the Lord, it's not like, you know, there's Monday and Tuesday, and then there's the day of the Lord, and then there's Thursday. Not like that. Day, in this sense, means like the whole era of time. The Hebrew word yom sometimes is referring just to a 24-hour period, but most of the time, it's kind of like our use of the term the day and age of whatever, you know, Queen Victoria or something like that. So the day of the Lord is a whole period of time, as it turns out, a 1,000-year period of time. And Paul is referring to this as this is the central teaching about when Christ returns and what's going to go down. It's the culmination of history predicted by the prophets, and it's both good news and bad news. And so what is the good news? The good news is that when Christ returns, it is a time of extraordinary blessing. The blessings of salvation described in the Old Testament come to their fulfillment when Christ returns. And so, for instance, we see that in the messianic reign, God's Messiah comes and establishes his rule on the earth. And it's described as shalom, a time of peace, a time where the nations themselves experience the healing that comes at the hands of a just and merciful ruler. And so, for instance, we have passages like Amos chapter 9, verses 11 and 12. In that day, see the language. In that day, I will raise up the fallen booth of David. In other words, I will bring back the monarchy of David. the greatest son of whom is the Messiah, son of David, Jesus Christ. And he says, I'm going to establish that throne, and all the nations, Amos says, who are called by my name, declares the Lord. And so in the day of the Lord, it's not just that Israel receives the blessings that that God intended and that God originally promised to Abraham all the way back in Genesis chapter 12, when he says, I'm going to make from you, Abraham, a great nation. And then later in chapter 15 of Genesis, that as numerous as the stars are in the heavens, so shall your descendants be. And there's this unique relationship of God to his chosen people, Israel. But the prophets understand, because they're being receiving revelation from God, that just as God is going to get his foothold into human history through Israel, actually his promise is as broad as humanity itself. That in the original promise God made to Abraham, the father of the Jewish people, he said, in you shall all the peoples of the earth be blessed. And the prophets are realizing that God's intent is not just to bless Israel, but actually through God's blessing to Israel, to bless all of the nations, as Amos says here, who are called by my name. And again, too, in Zechariah, at the end of the prophets in the Old Testament, Zechariah says, many nations will join themselves to the Lord in that day. Again, it's the day of the Lord language. And will become my people, and I will dwell in your midst, and you will know that the Lord of hosts has sent me to you. And here's another great promise of inclusion for all of the nations. There is a place at the table for you before God. And then finally, in Isaiah chapter 2, verses 2 to 4, he says, in the last days. That's language that Jesus, of course, will use later in the New Testament. In the last days, they will hammer their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not lift up sword against nation, and never again will they learn of war. A part of that verse is, of course, on the United Nations building in New York. A kind of a secularized version of this, that somehow we're going to pull it together and by our ingenuity and this, the greatness that is humanity, we're going to figure this thing out, and then the whole idea of war is going to be a byword. It's just going to be a part of the history, not a part of the future. And that's the hope, of course, of humanistic thinking. It was thought some years before the founding of the United Nations, before the First World War, which is called the War to End All Wars, that surely we can come together as a common humanity and figure these things out. And of course, that would just give rise to World War II. But the real hope is not in humanity getting our act together. The real hope that we have is in a God who will intervene in history and will establish his justice and his abundance on the earth, this peace that he brings. A time where the problem of man's inhumanity to man, that is really most clearly evidenced by and experienced by gross disparities of wealth and people who have not. Under God's rule, there will be a time of abundance. And so Isaiah 25, verse 6 says, in that day, the Lord of hosts will prepare a lavish banquet for all peoples on this mountain. That's Jerusalem. He says, a banquet of good wine and choice pieces of meat with the marrow, refined aged wine. That's not a typo. He mentions the wine thing a couple of times. I guess it's going to be really good vintage stuff. I don't know. Vintage 33 AD or something. I don't know. But the images that we have of God's presence in the world are very interesting, and very consistently, both in the Old Testament and in Jesus' teaching and at the end of history, as it's described in the book of Revelation, that to be in the presence of God is a party. It's a party where God is welcoming us in that Middle Eastern sense that to party with someone is to accept them, that we are part of each other's lives, that we are celebrating the sweetness of the life that we share together. And that's the image that we have of this phase of God's salvation history, this millennial rule, this time of abundance. We suffer from a lack of abundance in many places in the world because human beings are unjust. It's not that we lack the resources, it's that we lack the will. And under the just and righteous rule of God's Messiah, that's not going to happen. Everyone's going to have what they need and are going to be able to participate in this kind of close table fellowship with God's Messiah. That's just a remarkable thing. But at the same time, so this is the picture of the day of the Lord that is surely coming. And he will come back. But there's another thing that occurs, which is that the day of the Lord is a time of accountability. That God is breaking into history for a reason. And Isaiah chapter 2 verse 12 says that the Lord of hosts will have a day of reckoning against everyone who is proud and lofty, and against everyone who is lifted up. And so the day of the Lord comes as a time of blessing for those who are prepared to welcome God's Messiah, and for those who are continuing on in their defiant rebellion against God. As he says here, everyone who's proud and lofty and lifted up, it's not going to come so well for those folks, because there's not enough room in the cosmos for the will of God and for the will of those who would defy him. Now listen very carefully. This is a very important point. When it comes right down to the heart of things, what is the matter? What is the real core problem with humanity? Is it that we lack adequate understanding? Well, yeah, sometimes that's true. We do lack understanding and we are hurt by our ignorance. But that's not really the heart of the matter. Is the heart of the matter an economic question? That, well, if we just had a more fair distribution of the resources, that really all of our problems would go away and we would live in harmony with one another. And this, of course, also is not true. And even in places where there is more than enough abundance, we find chronic and crippling conflict among people, even in our own households. That's not the problem. The problem with humanity, as the Bible describes it, is a spiritual problem. The problem is that we, being created in the image of God, bear his image. We recognize something within ourselves, that there's a greatness about humanity. Biblical faith is the highest humanity. Because it says, or humanism, because it says that we are not just a hapless byproduct of a biological process that is indifferent to questions of meaning or purpose or rights or dignity. Why would one hunk of fungus have more rights than another? Or why would one hunk of fungus have an obligation to another to live a certain way? Of course, there's no basis for human dignity or how we treat one another if all we are is the outgrowth of some biological process like this. But if, like the Bible teaches, we are in the image of God, then there is something irreducibly valuable about every human being. If we are in the image of God, then intrinsically we are valuable because we are a part of his image. We have personality. We have self-awareness. We have a moral compass. We have the capacity for spiritual and personal relationships with other people. And God created us for the purpose of knowing him and to share in who he is. That's our highest good. But it carries with it also the very real possibility that humans created as free agents in the image of God can choose to arrogate to themselves the right of say-so about my life and what I'm going to live for and who I will serve and what I will be about. And the Bible teaches that it's this that is at the core of our problem. As Isaiah says, everyone who is proud, lofty, lifted up. This is terminology about the life of the ego, the self. That I am the source of all that is good for me. I am the source of what's true for me. I look no farther than my own self-interest. And the Bible says that at that place where our will comes in opposition to the will of a God who created us, that we become broken, alienated. Our very form as beings in the image of God is corrupted. And we experience that brokenness in the broken relationships that we have with one another. We experience it inwardly in our dealings with our own guilt and our failings. We deal with it in the sense that every agenda that we seem to have, that we pursue, that we go after, that is ego-promoting, that says, I'm going to do this thing, and so that's going to get me significance. That's what's going to give my life meaning and purpose. And it's a dead end, and it's all dead end, because that's not the way God created us to be. The basic problem with humanity is that we are in our pride and defiance of our Maker, who loves us and who continues to pursue us. That's our problem. Now, some of us here tonight are really increasingly aware that there's just something not right within, and we've maybe tried a lot of things to improve our situation. Maybe we've gone to some things, some groups that promote, you know, psychological well-being, or we've made some vows to do better and to pick ourselves up by the bootstraps, to do the right thing or whatever, and we're realizing I don't have the sustained willpower to make this happen, nor the confidence that if I did, it would make any difference at all. And so here you are, and here you sit in the unfolding of your own pride, and you see the dead end that that is. And it is at that point that God is calling out to you. God is calling out to you saying, see, I've got something better for you. I've got something better than the life of the pride, of the self-made man, of the I'm the measure of all things that matter to me. I've got life for you in relation to me available freely through Jesus Christ. The cross of Christ is the dividing line. The cross of Christ says that God has come into the world to take upon himself the burden of our rebellion, the cost of our great debt to God, the cost of the brokenness that we've brought into our own lives and into our world. And in the cross of Christ, Jesus takes upon himself God's just punishment for the wrongdoing, not just of the vast abstract humanity, but for each one of us as individuals. And he's calling out to us and he's saying, do you want me to interact with you on the basis of my mercy? Or do you want to get what you deserve, what you've earned? And the day of the Lord is that the day where that wedge is ultimately formed. Where do you stand in relation to God? Is it on the basis of your pride and I'll show him and I'm good enough? Or is it on the basis of a humble faith that reaches out to the sovereign Lord saying, be merciful to me, a sinner? So how does the day of the Lord come to you? As a blessing or as a time of accountability? That's up to you. That's a choice that you must make. You must make the decision to receive what God has provided for you in Christ. Well, moving on, the second important question then in the minds of these Thessalonians and for us as well is, okay, when does this go down? When does Christ return? And as it says there in verse 2, he says that he will come like a thief in the night. While they're saying peace and safety, destruction will come suddenly, like labor pains upon a woman with child. So this is the description of the when question. And notice that in no place in the Old Testament or the New are dates given for the return of Christ. Signs are given. There are things that we can look to anticipate the return of Christ. And we've already mentioned two of them. One, that there is a viable witness for Jesus Christ in among all language groups, along the lines of all ethnic peoples of the earth. That was Jesus' commission to the church in Matthew chapter 28. The second sign is that Israel is regathered and exists. So those are very measurable, clear signs that anticipate the return of God's Messiah. But no dates are given. And so it's important because Jesus himself says in Mark 13, verse 32, as for the day or the hour, the day of the Lord, again, the time of his return, no one knows, he says, not even the angels in heaven, not even the Son, but the Father alone. And it was apparently a decision that God the Father made with God the Son that Jesus Christ would come into the world and he would demonstrate the mercy of God by taking upon our sins on the cross, but that he would leave to the Father the specific time in which he would come and return and set up his rule on the earth. No date is known to any person. So if someone says, as has oft been the case, I know when Christ is coming. That happens every few years. In 1987, there was a book that came out called, you got it, 87 Reasons for 87. Some guy had written this thing where he's interpreting the Bible to say that there are 87 reasons for why we know that Christ will come back in 1987. Apparently, this guy knew more than Jesus himself. He says to his disciples, this is in Acts chapter 1. This is right before his ascension and right before he gives them the commission to go out and be his witness. The disciples ask, is it now that you're restoring the kingdom to Israel? Is this the day of the Lord, is what they're asking. And Jesus said, hey, it is not for you to know the times or epochs which the Father has fixed by his own authority. Nobody, Jesus doesn't know. The apostles don't know. Sorry to say it, folks, you don't know either. And neither do I. We don't know the date, but we do know that it will come unexpectedly. He describes it as like a thief in the night. You don't sit up at night waiting for the thief to show up, right? The whole idea of thievery is it's on the down low. You're not expecting it. And so that's why you are vulnerable and you get ripped off. And sad for you when that happens. I got my car broken into a couple weeks ago. I'm like, yeah, such a drag. I thought I locked the door, but no, I didn't. And boom, there it was. I was not expecting the disappointment of all the things I lost from my car. Well, there's a whole lot more at stake than a bunch of change in your car. There's a lot more at stake when Christ comes back. It says, while they are saying peace and safety, then destruction will come upon them suddenly. And so it's just these people who are totally unaware. Jesus describes it as people who are marrying and giving in marriage and they're just doing what they do and then all of a sudden, wham, boom, there he is. And it's like, oh, the party's over. We weren't ready for this. Oh, but you could have been. But you could have been. And that's what he goes on to describe. Like labor pains upon a woman with child, these signs will come to us. It's the same language that Jesus uses in Matthew 24, verse 8. The idea of labor pains, that there are things that are fairly common to human history, but which, like labor pains, become more frequent and more intense. And then at a certain explosive moment, whoom, out comes Junior. And that's what he's describing here. That's what labor pains refer to. Things that are not uncommon to human history, but which at the end time are just qualitatively different They're just way more intense, and they're way more frequent. And what is it that he's describing here? Three things that I want to very briefly describe. And this could take a several week series, but I just want to summarize what here Paul is relating to. First is the spiritual climate, which at the end of the era becomes far more toxic than at any other time. Here's what Paul says. In the last days, this is 2 Timothy. He says, in the last days, again, right in the thing that we're talking about here, difficult times will come. And men will be lovers of self, lovers of money, boastful, arrogant, revilers, disobedient to parents, ungrateful, unholy, unloving, irreconcilable, malicious gossips without control, brutal, haters of good, lovers of pleasure rather than of God. And those are their good qualities. Well, people have always been selfish. But he's describing here something that is just on a different level altogether. Lovers of self. And, you know, the whole idea of self and self-worship is something that is really, I think, unique in its intensity and its ubiquity and its global kind of embrace in our culture today. We are, well, some of us here, people like me, are what they call the me generation. The people who grew up in the 70s thinking that all of the world revolves around me and my interests and my needs and my desires, which are as intense as any black hole that could suck up the entire universe of desire. Arrogant lovers of money, the materialism that characterizes a culture of great affluence at the outer reaches of its spiritual ability to hold it together. That's what's being described here at the end times. He goes on, this is 2 Timothy 4 now, verses 3 and 4, the time will come when they will no longer endure sound teaching, but wanting to have their ears tickled, they will accumulate teachers in accordance with their own desires and turning away from truth to myths. And so, yeah, it's the whole idea here that in the smorgasbord that is the religious options at the end of the age, I just select those things that I want to be true for me, that really I want to be about. And it doesn't matter if they hold together or if they're rooted in anything real. It's just that I believe these things. I want them to be true. And so I choose that they are true for me. That's the spirituality that precedes the end of this age and the return of Christ. There's just something unique about our day, I'll have to say. I'm not prophesying the return of Christ at any time. But I will say, there is something very fundamentally different in the character of the spiritual climate today than at any point, certainly in Western history that we know of. The preoccupation with the deification of the self with its desires is just absolutely out of step with anything that has emerged in the history of religious faith. Very significant. Second, the man of lawlessness is described by Paul's second letter to the Thessalonians, 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. He says, the man of lawlessness, the son of destruction, opposes and exalts himself above every so-called god or object of worship, so that he takes his seat in the temple of God, displaying himself as being God. And so here is this person. What's his name? Come on. This is the Antichrist. Exactly. That's what he's describing here. The ultimate arrogance of a man aspiring to be a god. And who goes into God's temple. This is in Daniel chapter 11, verse 36, the abomination of desolation, it's called, where he goes in and accepts sacrifice to himself as a god. And that is a sign when a world leader of incredible charismatic ability and authority establishes himself as a God to be worshipped in Jerusalem, then you know, Jesus says this in Matthew 24, run. Run for the hills, because that's not going to stand very long. War and its effects. There's always been war, and the effects of war have always been devastating. We've lived through the bloodiest century in human history, the 20th century. And yet there's more to come. And this is the way it's described by Jesus. He says, unless those days had been cut short, no life would have been saved. But for the sake of God's chosen ones, these days will be cut short. And Jesus says, I'm going to return and establish my rule on the earth, not to put a wet blanket on everyone's party, but rather to prevent humanity from self-destructing. That's where it's heading. That's where it's heading. That's where humanity, apart from God, is heading for destruction. Not some creation of a human-made utopia where we finally figure out the answer to all our problems and can live together in harmony and hold hands across America and all of those things that we would like to believe is true. And which, in a certain sense, is true, that there is a basic value and dignity to humanity, but we are broken, and history bears out the soul of humanity in our barbarity against one another, in the legacy of war and all that brings. And so Jesus says, that is what precipitates my return. It's the desire to protect my humanity, my beautiful creation, from destroying themselves. In Revelation 8, verses 6 to 13, it describes war at the end of the era that is so violent that a third of the streams, a third of the forests, a third of humanity are destroyed. Impossible to describe, I think, in the framework of the first century writer, like someone like John in writing the book of Revelation. And it all comes to this place, this valley where the final battle is where they're squaring off, the battle in the Valley of Megiddo in Revelation 16, verses 13 to 16. These are the things that precipitate the return of Christ. War has always been terrible. War has never been of the sort that it is today, and with a level of lethality that can only be described as apocalyptic. So with these things then in view, Paul says, look, here's what's going to happen. The day of the Lord is coming. These are the things that will precipitate the return of Christ to establish his rule on the earth. And now what does it mean? How do I live with the end in mind? And it's how he closes in verse 8. He says, since we are of the day, let us be sober, having put on the breastplate of faith and love, and as a helmet, the hope of salvation. And so there it is, to be sober in relation to the faith, hope, and love. The three things that this letter has just consistently, every paragraph has gone back to. Now he's bringing it all together. Faith, hope, and love. What does it mean? Well, obviously to be clear-headed means to be clear-headed. And in an age like ours, an age of narcissism, an age of radical skepticism, where we are made to think that if we believe in the reality, the liberating power of Jesus Christ, we are totally out of step with our culture. A culture that really exalts self. A culture that kind of views the Christian message as something from the distant past, something that's irrelevant, something that constrains my freedom to do my thing my way. A God that inconveniently messes with my agenda for life. Christianity is kind of on the outs, as you have maybe recognized at this stage of the game. Some of it is brought upon ourselves because Christians act so foolishly in contrast with the biblical call to faith, hope, and love. But that being the case, to be sober in an unsober time is extremely important. And what that means is, first, to put on what he calls here the breastplate of faith. And what he means here, and the parallel actually is in Ephesians chapter 6, same analogy, it's to have an active and informed faith. In a world of confusion, of skepticism, of cynicism, in a world that accepts any moral framework as valid for the person who believes that it's true for them, there's something more important here, namely an active and informed faith that enables us to make sense out of life and to keep sober and alert and in the game as the world around us continues to fragment and fall apart. An active, informed faith means that we know what we believe. And very importantly, we know why we believe it. Why do you believe the things that you do? Christianity as a faith is not just wishful thinking. It's not just the faith of our fathers that I've accepted because it's just what we do in our family. An active and informed faith can answer the question, why do you believe that? Peter says that we must be prepared to give an account for the hope that is within us. And we need that ourselves to be able to engage with our faith the many things that seek to erode its foundations in our culture. Why do you believe? You've got to be able to answer that question. Love. Active, agape love. That's what he's describing here. The love of God, a radical alternative to a fragmented culture. Like our own, we're people, as Paul had earlier said, who are lovers of self. It's all about me. And what we do as a Christian community who have been formed by the narcissistic values of our culture, we've learned that it's all about us too. And for so many, Christianity just becomes sort of a veneer idea that, you know, being into God means that he'll give us what we want. Or people who go out and teach that kind of stuff. But that's not New Testament Christianity. It's active, effective love, a radical alternative to the selfishness and the self-centeredness and the narcissism of our day. And it's possible only if this isn't all there is. If this is all there is. If all you have is your bleep in time and then it's over. You have no reason to sacrifice your self-interest for anyone or anything. You got to grab what you can, the opportunity that presents itself now, because this may be all for you. And only if we have the kind of hope that we've been describing here tonight and over the last couple of weeks, can we actually make decisions in our lives to sacrifice self for the sake of others, knowing that we have nothing to lose. We have nothing to lose because we live in the hope of Christ's return and of our eternal dwelling in his presence. You cannot love if this is all you have. Maybe there will be some who would love those who love them, like Jesus said, but to truly lay your life down as a sacrifice, even for people who oppose you as enemies, you can't do that without hope. Faith and love require hope. Hope of salvation, the sustaining hope for our future transformation. The hope that the scriptures describe is a hope that brings real freedom in this life. Paul says in Romans 8:20 that the creation itself will be set free from its slavery to corruption, into the freedom of the glory of the children of God. There is coming a day where this world that we live in, as broken and as enslaved as we are to our own devices, to the limitations of our own character and our spiritual condition, that God will come and he will effect his work of salvation and he will establish his just and righteous rule, and we will be changed into his likeness as we respond to him in faith, and he will complete the work that he began in us when we first believed. We live in that hope. There's a freedom that comes There's no fear when you have hope. We are free from the demands of a world that is driving us to be all about self, all about now, all about me. The freedom that comes from knowing that God will put the broken pieces of our lives and of our world back together. It's not a pipe dream. It's not a pipe dream. There's a reason why faith, hope, and love work together in the Scriptures, both Old Testament and New. Faith is about the past. It's what God has done. The reality of God's work in human history that is fact. He did create. He did call a unique people. He did come into human history, and he did die on the cross and resurrect on the third day. Those are things that God has done. They're facts. And our faith rests in the finished work of Christ, the things that have been done, the factual nature of God's historic dealing with people. And on the basis of our faith in the accomplishments of God's work in the past, we can have hope in the fulfillment of God's promises for the future. Real hope, not a pipe dream hope, but a real hope that is rested in God's faithfulness already demonstrated in the past. The past is the anchor for faith. The future is the anchor for hope. So that between two certainties, we can live in the present. We can experience and we can be agents of God's love in the present. Because we've got that kind of foundation. A foundation and a living knowledge and relationship with Jesus Christ that gives us both the insight and the power to love and the hope of His return in the future to seal His work in our lives and in the cosmos. And so we can just give ourselves without reservation to what He calls us to love one another and to love those who are hard to love and who are lost. And that's how this whole thing works together. That's the nature of the Christian life. This is an amazing paragraph of Scripture because it just brings it all together.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.